what I'd like to do is in these two sessions is, and you may not, they're two complete separate sessions. You may already have plans for hiking or something tomorrow. I don't mean to say that you have to come tomorrow to make tonight worthwhile. But tonight, I would like to talk specifically about South Africa and some background on South Africa and some reasons why it's important and what's happening there and the struggle for liberation there. And I want to, as much as possible, stay in that realm. Tomorrow, I'd like to talk about, tomorrow morning at, what time is that session, Larry?
10:45.
I'd like to talk about the United States and the United States churches in relationship to South Africa. I don't have any particular title for tonight's session, but the title to tomorrow morning session is The South Bronx-South Africa Connection. I live in, for those of you who don't know, I live and work in the South Bronx in New York City. And I'll tell you in advance, one of the parts of that is when people visit me from Soweto in South Africa, which is the 1.5 million or 1.25 million population city in South Africa that is their black ghetto, but it's outside the city. It's 15 miles from Johannesburg and is the servant community for the 500,000 city of population of Johannesburg and for the gold mines, digging gold mines. Anyway, when they come visit me in South Bronx, they say, oh, I understand, your Soweto was inside the city. And that's the connections are quite obvious from there on. So South Bronx is the poorest urban community in the United States, but it's not that far different from many others. Well, I want to talk about that tomorrow and about the our economic and political involvement as a nation in South Africa and our economic and church involvement, in specifically the campaign that I'm involved in to deal with the fact that the LCA and the ALCA each have about 1/3 of their pension investments and other investments in corporations that are in South Africa. And so I have some deep feelings about my pension being made on South African apartheid system. So we'll talk about that tomorrow too. Pardon?
I think the ALC voted to take theirs out.
No, they only voted to take it out of two corporations.
Oh, I see.
Out of Citibank and out of what's the company that gives out cards and traveler's checks? American Express.
Oh.
Okay, that's a preview for tomorrow to say we're going to get there, and a couple of times tonight in our discussion we may say, well, that's more on tomorrow's agenda, and if you're taking a hike, I hope you enjoy yourself. Just in background on South Africa, do you have a map of South Africa in your mind? Do you have a map of Africa in your mind? That gigantic continent, and the bottom southern cone of which has been the center of turbulence for, the whole of Africa has been the center of turbulence. Over the last 30 years ago, 90% more or less, or 93% of South Africa was colonial, was under the colonial rule of European, primarily European countries. In the incredible revolutionary changes taking place in Africa is that is all excepting for South Africa and Namibia, and South Africa is not a colony in the sense in that it's not ruled from the outside just by a white minority from the inside, and so that Namibia, I think, is that true, Larry? That Namibia is the only country in South Africa anymore under colonial administration. Anyway, virtually, pardon?
What was the name of that country again?
Namibia, that South Africa administers. I think so. Anyway, that kind of a change in 30 years' time, that politically independent Africa 30 years ago was totally colonial Africa. Now it's still under what they call neocolonialism, a tremendous economic dependence upon the American and European countries. We'll talk a little bit about that, but it's that kind of a turmoil. And a lot of that has just been recently. If you remember, it's only a couple of years ago that Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau won their independence after 15 years of guerrilla warfare from Portugal. It's only just this year. When did Zimbabwe? January? March? It's only the last few months that Zimbabwe, what was Rhodesia, became an independent country after a long, long struggle. So we're right in the middle of of that. And as that colonial independence grows, the pressure grows on the last and strongest brutage of white domination of Africa that has ever been, and the focus keeps getting closer and closer, and the pressure more and more on the Republic of South Africa, a country that has approximately 26 million people in it, and 4 million of them are white, and it is totally and exclusively run by, owned by, the 4 million whites. The 20 million black and colored and Asian that live there, or 22 million approximately, have absolutely no rights whatsoever. It is virtually slavery. They have no voting rights, no property rights, no any kind of representational rights in the legislature. Pardon?
This is throughout.
This is South Africa. That bottom country. And that's the country I want to talk about. And then just north of that, this is just that southern bottom of Africa. And South Africa more or less runs like that. And just northwest of that is another country that used to be called Southwest Africa. I want to talk a little bit about that. Now it's called Namibia. And this is the Republic of South Africa. And then all of these countries in here are countries that have just recently become liberated, free for the most part, all of them. And include Angola and Mozambique and Rhodesia, which is now Tanzania, and then the rest of Africa. But I want to talk about this and this. This is the Republic of South Africa, 26 million people, ruled totally, owned totally, exclusive rights totally to the 4 million white people who live there. Let me say by way of introduction that, two things. First of all, that tonight and tomorrow morning, I want to say a lot about the awfulness of South Africa and the awfulness of our nation's support for the white government of South Africa. But I don't want to leave us there. I don't want to leave us just in the negative kind of thing. What's really exciting is that there is, amongst those 22 million black people of South Africa, a sense of a struggle for freedom that is one of the most exciting things you could possibly think of. And in the churches of South Africa and of Namibia, the people of Jesus Christ are in the middle of that struggle. And that's what I really want to emphasize. And I also want to emphasize our responsibility for being in the middle of that too, not just our, sense of being, oh, aren't we awful people, but the sense of our having a real exciting participation in that struggle for freedom, which has something to do with our becoming more free also. The first thing I'd like to say, though, is something about why South Africa, why this country, when you and I could make, asked us to brainstorm a list of countries of which we're aware there are injustices, that people are struggling for freedom, we'd fill up the blackboard with your favorite country or my favorite country, my favorite list of oppressions. And we'd fill up the board with countries which are, we're filled with oppression, and our country would not be left out of the list. Our country would be in that list too. I want to just simply say, first of all, something about why select out South Africa as sort of the king of evil. somehow symbolically might be today, if the Book of Revelation, Dan, were written today, might originate in South Africa first, and the beast would be very clearly Botha, King Botha, the Prime Minister of South Africa, as above all the others. And there's two things about it that I think that makes it more so than, more than Russia, more than the United States, more than Ethiopia, more than Cambodia, more than any of the others, which is of the top of my list of countries where there is evil. And there's two reasons. One is, I think it's the only nation in the world which constitutionally requires the injustice, which constitutionally says it is right to be doing it. Now, we did that up until 1865 in slavery. And it wasn't until 1965 that we really began to legally deal with it seriously. So that's only 15 years ago, so I'm not trying to be self-righteous about this. But it's the only country in the world that I know of that says, that looks at its injustice and says it's constitutionally required and you can be arrested if you don't do it. Now, the injustices that you think of when you think about countries like Cambodia or the United States or Russia or any other place you know of injustice, their constitutions call for justice. And if there is injustice, and if the United States or Russia or any other country admits to its injustice, they will say, okay, we got some evil, but it's contrary to our intentions. Now, their constitutions say otherwise. The Republic of South Africa's constitution, and I had it in my packet and it's gone. I wanted to read you the new constitution that's been introduced into the South Africa. They're going to have a new one. They're having a constitutional convention. They're going to be having a new constitution, which will, as I'll tell you about in a few moments, define blacks as no longer citizens. And I'll tell you about that in a few minutes. But constitutionally, it says it's right. And in fact, you will be arrested and thrown in jail if you don't obey the constitution and be unjust. Okay, that's the first thing. And I don't know, you may say, I know a country that's that way too, but I haven't found one yet that actually constitutionally defines and requires it. The second thing, it's even closer to our Christian hearts, is that it is theologically defended also as being right. In the Dutch Reformed Church, which is the main sort of the state church of South Africa, there are other churches, but it's sort of the church of the heritage of the Afrikaner people, the people who came originally from Holland, has all along defined and defended the white people of South Africa as being God's new Israel. And on all the terms of you can think of Israel going through the desert and over the Jordan into God's holy land and having the right to smash the Hittites and the Canaanites and wipe them out, rule over them, and we are God's holy people. All of that is in the South African people. Well, if you go to their Voortrekker monument, which is their frontiersman's monument, which celebrates the same thing as we had, a frontier expansion with Conestoga wagons. While we were doing that here, they were doing that there. And then they have this big thing, and in the Voortrekker monument, which is about 10 stories high and a great cathedral thing, and you have to whisper in place, and you're thrown out if you don't whisper. And it's obscene is what it really is. I had a headache before I left, but it's in the middle of it all. They have this, you know, those lamps we used in our Conestoga wagons, the oil lamps that swing back and forth. They got one there that's an eternal light, like we have for John Kennedy down Washington, an eternal light that's always burning. And in back of that, they have a big plaque and says something to the effect of, dedicated to the people who in the name of God brought the light of civilization and still keep the light of civilization alive in dark Africa. It's written deep, deep, deep in their understanding of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ, to be this elitist, enslaving people. Once again, we can't be self-righteous. We've got a little bit of that in the United States in our history. Manifest destiny, in the sense of God called us to, and somehow God was used as an excuse for a wiping out of the Indians. So we got a lot of that in our history. So I don't want to set this up as the only great evil in the world, but it's an important thing because they still maintain as it being that kind of thing. And even the white Lutheran church in South Africa, and there are a lot of tiny little white Lutheran churches, and then a very, very large black Lutheran church. The white Lutheran churches, I had some of the people who were in the church councils of those white Lutheran churches brag to me that they were more loyal to the South African government than the Dutch Reformed Church. So I can't even step outside and say, well, it's those dumb DRCs, the Reformed Church. You know, it's part of the white consciousness of South Africa that Jesus Christ died to make this possible. And that's really hard, and so it's really got to become a very special reason for our being concerned about it. So those two things of why South Africa, that it's constitutionally and theologically defended as that evil situation being right. OK, Okay, let me just tell a little bit about the structure of South Africa. I don't want to spend a whole time just doing background material, but it's important just to know something about how that all is and how it came to be. There are 22 million blacks and 4 million whites. Of those 22 million blacks, about 18 million of them are what you think of when you think of Africans, black Africans, coming out of the ancient tribes of Africa. Of the 4 million remaining, about 2.5 or 3 million of them are so-called colored people. Or what might be called by some people in our southern part of the United States as mulattoes. In the United States, as I'm sure you're aware, the shades of people of color go from deep black until to the very light shades of tan, and that came about by slave masters in the United States taking the slave women as their concubines and having children by them. That's exactly what happened in South Africa. The colored population that developed around Cape Town, although it didn't scatter itself out as it does with us, it's a very separate group, and they've developed into a separate consciousness as being colored other than black, and the South African whites have encouraged that. They try and keep them separate, although they lie about how it comes into being. One of the things about South Africa, which is, if it weren't so evil, it would be funny, is the lies they make up to the pretend about how things happen. And the white education system goes by the awful name of the Christian National Education Program. And it's in that national education program that most of the lies are taught. And the consciousness of white people is created so that they actually believe all these things are true. And the Christian National Education Program teaches that the colored race came into being because of visiting sailors. And it goes into paragraphs about all these visiting sailors who came and made and slept with African prostitutes. That's no more true than any lies about how the lighter-skinned black people came into being in the United States. So they have about 2.5 of the colored people. They live mostly in the very, very southern tip of Cape Town, one of the most beautiful cities in the world physically. And then the other, about 1.5 million, are Asian, Indian and Malaysian, who were brought over as indentured servants, the same as the Asian people were brought here from China to build our railroads. And by the way, while I'm mentioning them, one of South Africa's greatest gifts to the world, although they don't acknowledge it, they're very ashamed of it, but we should be very proud, that one of South Africa's greatest gifts to the world is a man by the name of Mahatma Gandhi, the liberator of India. He came in the early 1900s as a young lawyer to South Africa because he heard that his people were in trouble in South Africa. And there he developed all of his teachings and all of his practices of nonviolent protest and of liberation. And then he went back to India and became the liberator of India. And his influence upon people in the United States like Martin Luther King have been such a gift to the world. And to think that South Africa unwillingly and unwittingly made that gift to the world is really one of the neatest and most marvelous things that you can think of. Of the English-speaking people, the 4 million English-speaking people, the 4 million white people, half of them are English-speaking, and half of them are Afrikaans-speaking. And there's a great deal of hostility and cultural enmity between them. They have great unity in their being white and ruling a nation as a minority. But the so-called Boer War, B-O-E-R, B-O-E-R is another name for the Afrikaans, that took place in the early part of this century, in which England, it was when South Africa was still a colony of England, England defeated the Boers, and since then there has been a great deal of hostility between them, and it was only in 1948, very short time ago, that the Afrikaners won all of the elections and took over the government of South Africa. And at that time they said, we finally won the Boer War. And since that time, politically, the 2 million Afrikaans speaking have been primarily those who run the government and have been building up ever since this system called apartheid. And that's the official name for the system of segregated government that South Africa has. Apartheid. You see the word apart in it? South Africans sometimes pronounce that apartheid. And then people who take that word and want to take it back to what it really means, they say it means apartheid. But apartheid is the official system of government that's been built since 1948, had a lot of designs practiced before then, but it became part of the official government. And since that time, the Afrikaner people have been ruling. Now, there are four legs that support that apartheid system. And that's all the lectures on political structures I'll make tonight. But it's important that we may understand the four legs that apartheid system exists on. The first is the one that we probably understand the most because of our history, just the basic system of segregation. It's much more complicated there because they segregate four groups of people from each other, not just black and white. Their laws also make it illegal for black and colored to mix, and colored and Indian to mix. And so when they obey their laws, if you wanted to take a bus from here to Lucerne, you'd have to take four buses. You have to take a white bus and an Indian bus and a colored bus and a black bus. Except you'd probably make the blacks walk, because they don't even deserve buses except to get to work. If you want to have a restaurant, you'd have to have four restaurants. A white restaurant, a colored restaurant, and an Indian restaurant. And then, once again, you probably wouldn't have a black restaurant because outside of the homelands and the townships where blacks are allowed to live, there are no other restaurants. So if they came to work in your factory, there would be no place for them to eat. They'd have to go out on the sidewalk and eat anything they carry. People, and it's absolutely an absurd system. You go into a public governmental building where they have to obey all the laws. They have to at least obey their own laws. And you find eight toilets. It's just incredible. White men and white women, white colored colored men and colored women, Indian men, Indian women, black men and black women. Except they might not have a toilet for black men people because they don't need toilets. I mean, it's that kind of a system. But the basic system of segregation, which is really only an absurd extension of the kind of system of segregation we had even until 1965 in the United States. So it's somewhat similar to us. But that's only one of the legs that this is built on. And as a matter of fact, that's the leg that South Africa is most willing to compromise on and begin to make some things to let go. The three others are far more important to them. And the first is the migrant labor law, which says there are nine traditional homelands of the black South African people. And I'll talk about those in a few moments a little bit more, but they are the only places that it is legal for a black South African to live. For them to be any place else, they have to have a permit. That's part of the apartheid separate system. Everybody carries a pass. You were mentioning that this morning, Dan. Everybody carries what they call, it's an awful name they give it, the Book of Life. And in that has to be their name and their address and where they come from, their family, and their permit to be where they are if they're not in their homeland. And like, for example, here in Johannesburg, if you look at a map of South Africa, any map of South Africa, you'll see Johannesburg, but you won't see on any map of Africa the name of Soweto, which is the second largest or the largest city of Africa, is not on anybody's map because it's not an official city. It's a place where it stands for Southwestern Townships. A township is where black people are permitted to live so long as they have a permit to work. But as soon as they run out of their permit to work, they're illegal and they have to go back to their homeland. The migrant labor system is a system of contract labor where they sign an 11-month contract to come and live in a township and work in the white man's factories, or in the mines, or in the homes. When they originally started the migrant labor system, they couldn't find any black person who was out of his mind enough to want to do that. So they had to put taxes on their homes that they had to pay annually that were too high for them to earn money for there, so they were forced into migrant labor. Forced so that they could pay their taxes. And to force them into the country. And mainly it was to go down into the gold mines, and the Kimberley, and the diamond mines, and to be servants in the houses. And they evolved, what evolved was the migrant labor system of 11 months of the year coming and living in a barracks, and a barracks might be this size and have about 60 people living in it, and you each have your cot. And you live there 11 months of the year, and allowing 1 week for travel, you get to see your family for 3 weeks of the year. You may not have your family with you until you've worked in the same job for 10 years. The entire industrial system of South Africa and the entire servant labor system of South Africa is built on the migrant labor system. The 22 million blacks, and especially the 18 million African blacks, live as an economic function of the white, of that small white minority. In the Christian National Education Program, the children are taught that that does not hurt the black people because there is no family system in the black culture. That's directly taught pages and pages about the black culture, which filled with those kinds of lies. The second leg is the migrant labor system. First, the basic separation, segregation, the second, migrant labor. Third is job reservation system. And that means that all jobs are reserved for white people. Down, if you start at the top of management and go down to the bottom of the labor system, job reservation system has a moving measuring stick. And so long as there is white labor that wants a job, a black person may not go above that. And so long as there is not a white person wanting a job, a black person must fill that. So the job reservation system basically says, it's much more complicated than that, but basically says that jobs are reserved for white people that want them. It's the only country I've ever been that class and race are coincidental. We have, in our country, for example, we have lots of poor whites and lots of poor white laborers and race, and we do have some people in a small percentage of black people, people of color, in the upper classes. But it's the only country I've ever been in is by law, it is regulated so that class and race, the line between the two, are coincidental. So the third leg on which the South African system is built is the job reservation system. And then the fourth one, and it's the most important one because it's the one that we are being most lied to about, as we need to be most aware of, is the homelands development system, or the homeland system. I mentioned that there are nine homelands. And to help us understand what a homeland is, think reservation. Think Indian reservation. It's 13% of the land that has been reserved for approximately 83% of the people. And South Africa has been in the process during the last 10 years and expects to complete it soon. I don't know what their exact timetable is, of making out of each of those nine homelands a puppet independent country. That is declaring each of those homelands independent in a very phony kind of way, that there's still the migrant labor system that makes them an economic puppet to South Africa. The army and the police are still run by the South Africa, and no person who lives on those was asked if they wanted to be one, wanted to be independent. But every black, when this is completed, every black South African, every one of the 18 million black South Africans will be assigned to be a citizen of one of those homelands and declared to no longer be a citizen of South Africa. And when that's completed, South Africa then intends to declare themselves a democracy. That everyone who is a South African may have a vote. So it's basically an exporting of 18 million people into a foreign country the final step of the apartheid system.
Would the colors of the union be reasonable to allow to vote?
That they will have, as it stands now, their intentions are to give them a limited franchise.
Just in their own homeland? Or?
Yeah. No, not in their own homeland, living in South Africa. They will not be a homeland for the colored or for the Indian.
How would they be able to keep the blacks having to go to work in the factories and mines that if they no longer had the power to tax them? Or would it be the fact that there were no jobs in Finland?
No jobs in the migrant labor system. It's also in the country, there's three independent countries. There's a country right north of that called Botswana, and a little country here called Swaziland, and right in the middle of South Africa called Lesotho, who are also part of that migrant labor system, even though they're independent. But these nine countries would even be less independent than those countries. It would be literally puppet governments. It would be as if we took our reservations and went one step further and said, Rosebud Reservation is now a country. Or whatever a reservation is here in Seattle, or Washington, I don't know the name of a reservation.
Colville.
Colville is a nation. And without asking the Indians, saying, you are now citizens of that nation, not of the United States, and to come off of that, you must have a permit. But your police system and your army system and your industrial system are still run by us. Three of those, just to give an illustration, three of those have already been created. So there's only six more to go. And one is the Transkei, and the other is one up in here called Bota Botswana, and then, I don't remember the name of the third one. It just came into being about a few months ago. Do you remember, Larry? Anybody know?
No, I just have a question about our reservations. Aren't they independent nations? I thought they were.
No. They're part of the United States. They're citizens. I don't know how. Are they? No.
Yeah, they are still citizens of the United States, but they are independent. They have their own food system.
Yeah.
On their reservation, they can prosecute you through their own system.
Yes. And the whole paternalistic Bureau of Indian Affairs, the administration of that. I'm not trying to say that ours is a just system compared to theirs. I think they're both unjust. They've gone one step further.
Because they can't get off of their reservations without.
Well, they have obviously have enough people that want to do that, so they're able to get a president and a vice president and a Congress in Transkei. But they're all that small minority who is sold out to that and or being bought now or whatever. But the vast majority of people either are just unconscious of that, or you're just part of like slaves are. The mentality of slaves is created by slave masters who are unaware of what's being done to them, or if they're aware, who are totally opposed to that, and know something of the unworkability of it. Unworkable, for example, in that those three that have been created have been recognized by no government in the world as a country. No government in the world, except for a tiny little African nation I know nothing about called Malawi. I know nothing about it, so I won't even try and explain that. But no other nation of the world recognizes the existence, and certainly not the United Nations, of those three so-called countries, and of the six more to come. It's the final plan of creating concentration camps for Black South Africans. It's the ultimate solution to the white South African problem.
Is there any feasible plan to reverse what's happening? Does someone have a plan that could reverse it? It would seem an enormously difficult thing to ever work those different cultures of people together. What do you know about that?
In just about 10 minutes, I want to switch to efforts to change it, to bring about change. And we'll deal with that directly about what kind of struggles are taking place to work for change in that.
You said that most of the jobs are reserved for the whites, right?
Yes, or above a certain, well, not most of the jobs, but jobs above a certain level.
So what kind of work do the people in these homelands do?
The only work they do for which they receive pay is to come off the homelands.
in the migrant labor system.
What about education?
There's a separate education system that South Africa has for black people and I don't have the numbers, the exact figures with me, that approximately between an eighth and a tenth of the amount of money per pupil paid for blacks as is paid for whites in terms of education, and goes up, I think, to the sixth grade. And while it's a totally free system for the whites, the blacks have to pay to go. And it's a totally separate system. However, there are black universities. You know, for the administration of 22 million black people, you need black doctors, black lawyers, black people who will administer, black preachers who will administer and care for the survival of those people. And the white system creates that to come into being also. But of course, a black doctor would not be able to touch a white person or anything like that. And there's one black doctor for every 50,000 people, I think is the figure. But they do have that system of creating capabilities of the black people to provide for their survival needs. But did you have your hand up, ma'am?
No.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
I think it's important to add, Joe, that in addition to the migrant workers who are working in the cities of South Africa and black Africans who are living on the homelands, that is, usually the rest of the family, that one third of the blacks of South Africa work on white farms. And they many times have been living there from generation to generation to generation, as have the white family has been living there from generation. I mean, that is a plantation society, and has been for 150 years. And that's a lot of folks.
Yes. And it's in that context that the 10-year law came into being, that legalized that plantation system of saying after 10 years, they had to legalize that which was de facto in existence. That it should be said that the English-speaking people are primarily the urban and industrial people, and the Afrikaans-speaking people are the farmers, the lands people, and over the years have developed these gigantic plantations in the country and farms, in which, as Larry says, the migrant system has almost, it's like if you think of the migrants coming up from Mexico to do the picking, and over the years has evolved Chicano communities, and it's not even accurate to talk about migrant workers in California and Oregon and Washington, I understand, because many of them are permanent communities and not ones who constantly migrate. And that's the same thing that's happened in a very heavy plantation
system. It makes efforts to organize a black community extremely difficult, because you just have a group of blacks living on a farm and that's a generation.
There's a hand here.
Are there among these black educated people who help to minister or administer the black homelands areas, is there any kind of organization among them, or are they pretty much puppets of the white government?
That's a complicated question. To answer it very generally and oversimplify it, there are many of them who are puppets or sold out to the government and enjoy their special prestige. But I would guess that there are far, far more of them who serve their people and are servants to their own people and care about their people and are struggling for and waiting for the day of liberation. The development of since the beginning of this century of liberation movements have had those people deeply, deeply involved in their leadership. Well, that's an oversimplified answer, but to say that it falls on both sides, but mostly that the leadership of the liberation struggle is filled with such persons. Marvin?
Does the homelands law then mean that as it goes into effect, that people who live on farms, the families of the workers will have to move to homeland? How will that handle all people who
Well, to answer that, I have to say that that South Africa, for the most part, pretends that all its laws works. And has to live with a great deal of illusion and pretending about themselves. For example, the people who administer it used to be called the Bantu system, and they have a new plural something or other. They keep changing their titles for it, pretending they're humanizing it by giving it more human titles. People who administer that swear to you that absolutely, according to the latest census, there are only 750,000 people living in Soweto. In fact, there are almost double that number, and there's no way of controlling it. And so they just live with the pretense that it isn't true. And also, as the whole homeland system that I've described to you is in fact unworkable, and most people predict that somewhere down the line, if South Africa gets away with even creating it, finishing the nine countries, that it'll collapse under its own weight, and just the impossibility to follow their own laws and to create somebody was saying last night that if we had 1/10 of our youth refusing to register, the penal system of the United States would not be able to handle it. South Africa could not stand administering 1/10 of the people who are living in violation of its laws. So they just live in a total... So in that context, I don't know the answer to that, but in the context of whatever law they passed, they couldn't enforce. In the creating of the Transkei over the last year and a half to 2 years, with most of the people who have been assigned to be citizens of the Transkei living down in the Cape Town area and over in the Port Elizabeth area, the only way they have been able to even begin to try and force those people back to the Transkei, if you remember from your TV sets, some of the times when this actually created such a scandal that it came over our own TV sets, they went in with bulldozers and just announced into these tiny little shanty towns made out of tin and so forth of the black townships, and they would announce, everybody out of your houses, no time to take your furniture, no time to pack a suitcase, no time to pick up anything, and just bring in their bulldozers and smash in the course of a day thousands of shanties, and then bring the buses and then take them over to the Transkei. And then still most of them being, starting their walk back because they couldn't survive in the Transkei anyway. I mean, it's just a totally unworkable system. And the scandal of and as I'll talk about tomorrow morning about people's consciousness, I have a friend of mine in New York who's a political exile by the name of Dumasani Gumalo from South Africa, and he says, we didn't talk about caterpillars and bulldozers coming in and smashing our places. We talked about American tractors coming in and smashing our places. And he says, every time the police took me to jail, I didn't say I was taken to jail, and I would go home and talk to my mother and say I wasn't taken to jail in a Ford or a Chevy. They would say I was taken to jail in an American truck. I want to talk tomorrow about their consciousness of our participation in their oppression. But the incredible way that they administer this is absolutely impossible. I've got to move on. I want to say quick about 3 minutes about Namibia. And then I want to talk about the church and resistance, because that's more, this is all very depressing, and it's evil, it's beastly, it's indescribably evil. But what's even more exciting is the life of resistance and the life of survival and the life of the liberation struggle that's taking place. It's another exodus. It's a tremendous struggle. Southwest Africa was first colonized by Germany in the latter part of the last century. And this is a horrible story. I'm sorry I have to tell you another horrible story. I usually try and tell the story about Mahatma Gandhi alongside of this so that you get a good story along with a very horrible story. The second administrator general of the colony of Southwest Africa for Germany was a man by the name of Heinrich Goring. Heinrich Goring developed the extermination practices to wipe out 75% of the Herero tribe. And that story is in itself a horrible one. And it's also horrible to know that the German domination culturally of Namibia is still so strong that even Goring Street is still the main street of that town. It's still haven't changed the name of it. The most horrible part of that story is that his son, Herman, grew up there and learned it all from his daddy and went home to become the butcher of Germany. So South Africa's gift of Mahatma Gandhi has to be balanced with the gift of Hermann Göring to the world. 1917, when Germany lost World War I and lost all of her colonies, the League of Nations divided up her colonies, and England got Southwest Africa to administer, and England turned that job over to South Africa when it was still part of the Commonwealth. And then when it became the Republic of South Africa, South Africa claimed the right, without anybody around to protest it, to still administer the colony of Southwest Africa, with her intentions of eventually making it part of South Africa and administering it exactly under the same oppressive laws of South Africa. Finally, and this is where I want to switch to the positive side, finally in 1966, with a lot of pressure and a lot of struggle by the Namibian people and by many, many other people in the process, in 1966, just 14 years ago, the United Nations took away the right of South Africa to administer Southwest Africa, recognized an organization called SWAPO, Southwest Africa People's Organization, as being, and who are in exile for the most part, and living in Angola and in the United Nations, as being the official representatives of Namibia. And since 1966, South Africa has refused to obey that law, to obey that declaration. But since 1966, South Africa has been right to do what she is doing, has been actually taken from her, and that she's now living outside the law. And now that the struggle of Zimbabwe has been liberated, that the next struggle you'll see in the next year will be the pressure on South Africa to let go of Southwest Africa. Namibia, you should know, is about, I think, about 80% Lutheran. Germany was a colony of Germany. The Rhenish Missionary Society began to missionize amongst the Namibians in the southern part of Namibia, and the Finnish people began to work with the Ovambo people, who live in it's half the population of Namibia, which lives on the top quarter inch of the map, and 80% of that country is Lutheran, and that, in terms of my experience, I have never, ever in any part of the world experienced or heard of a church that is so deeply, closely committed to its people and living with its people and a part of its people and sharing in the sufferings of its people and participating in the struggle of the people for liberation. So many times, we should be embarrassed, I think, that so many times when countries become liberated, like Angola or Mozambique or whatever, when countries become liberated from an oppressor, the church has up until that point so much identified and had an allegiance with the oppressor side that the new government has had to limit the rights of the church because of the evil the church has done. When liberation comes to Namibia, we should see an opposite story. The church has been so close to the life of the people that we can at least anticipate and hope for that the church will be one with the people in celebrating freedom and will not have that kind of limits put on them.
There are some people, some good Lutherans, and I shouldn't use that word, some Lutherans in the United States who have been supporting the Lutherans in Namibia through Parkinson Mission.
Yes.
And some in the state of Washington have done it very liberally.
Parkinson Mission, some of you don't know, is sort of an independent mission arm of the AELC.
That's right.
And it's in St. Louis.
Very
really
proud of it.
Exciting. And I'm excited to be a part of AELC myself. I mean, of Partners in Mission. Mm-hmm. I'm not AELC, but I work with Jim Mayer quite closely.
You said 80% are Lutheran. Now, is that 80% of the people are Lutheran or 80% of the Christians are Lutheran?
I think the country is virtually 100% Christian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Is that true? I don't know, Larry, you may know if you're better than
I. No. I think one thing that is very significant is the Walvis Bay port. There's a deep water port in Namibia, as well as great mineral rights like diamonds and uranium. But the Deepwater Port now is all the Marshall delegates in Zimbabwe has come about, because if Namibia becomes an independent nation, then you can draw a line from a port on the west out of Walvis Bay over the top of South Africa to Mozambique and to by way of also Zimbabwe, and that begins regional economic development among black African states that can start to cut their presently extreme economic dependence upon South Africa. The South Africa knows that, and where they will not give in is on the rights to Walvis Bay.
They'll let Namibia go free, but they don't want to let Walvis Bay be.
Yeah,
we should be aware and you know, regret but not forget that the main reasons why we so resist, and we'll talk about this tomorrow morning more, why Europe and the United States and other parts of the so-called developed world resists the economic liberation of most of Africa and still resists getting on the right side in South Africa is the extreme mineral wealth of those countries. In Namibia alone, in the Namib Desert, after which Namibia is named, possibly half of the uranium supply of the world. And let alone all the gold and the diamonds and the extension of the Katanga province of Zaire coming in there, European dominance there is extremely important to know why we live in contrast and in contradiction of our own principles of freedom and human rights. Because of the controlling economic forces and greed that makes us not want to let that go.
David said that our American investments in South Africa are greater than our investments in Southeast Asia and Iran combined. Give you some idea of the struggle that's ahead there.
The people of South Africa, my experience of the black people of South Africa and Namibia is one of a sense of what it, I don't know if you can picture it in the Exodus story of what it must have been like somewhere after the eighth or ninth plague, and which you know it's going to still be a bloody time ahead, but you know that freedom's got to come. And the people of South Africa and Namibia, the black people, have a deep sense of the inevitability of they will be free, of this government will collapse. This government will not be for much longer. But they also know that between now and then lies the extreme probability of a very, very bloody battle and the capabilities of the white government of South Africa committing the kind of Holocaust that we know of experienced in Europe. And so that they live with these two great dimensions of feelings, of freedom being inevitable, tastable within one's lifetime, but also knowing that, especially with the tremendous power of the white Western world supporting the white government of South Africa economically, that the struggle between now and then can only be one of an extremely difficult one and probably a very, very violent and bloody one. The Afrikaner people, those 2 million whites that are in charge in South Africa, are not like colonists. They're not like the British colonists or even the English-speaking South Africans who have a consciousness inside of them that they have someplace else to go. You know, we're only visiting here. You go to a cocktail party and the English-speaking liberals of South Africa and the main talk is, do you know where you're going when you have to leave, and have you got your money out yet? You know, and you have all in your consciousness, you have to say, I've got someplace else to go. The white Afrikaner people have a deep sense of this is our home. We have no place else to go, and they are rooted in. And the black South Africans believe that. They say, you're Africans. We don't want you to go. We're not opposed to your being here. We're opposed to racism and your dominance of us. And we want to build a country that's of both of us.